everybody to the spring McIntyre Lecture for History and Philosophy of Science. This lecture series functions as a means to explore the power and the limits of science and how it's related to faith. We're going to have, I think, a really fun time doing that this evening. So let me say a few words about Dr. Jennifer Powell McNutt, who some of you probably know, and well, maybe everybody in the room knows. She is Associate Professor of Theology and History of Christianity here at Wheaton. She did her BA in Religious Studies at Westmont, so a competitor of Wheaton, but we consider that to be a friendly competitor, sister college. She did a PhD in History from the University of St. Andrews, particularly in the Reformation Studies Institute, and also has an MDiv from Princeton Theological Seminary. The focus of her work is the history of Christianity from the Reformation through the Enlightenment, and you'll see some of that represented in what she'll be talking about this evening. She's also an elected fellow of the Royal Historical Society, as well as a recipient of the American Society of Church History's Brewer Prize for her monograph, Calvin Meets Voltaire, which if you think, oh, couldn't that be a cartoon like Calvin and Hobbes? No, but it's more interesting, perhaps, than Calvin and Hobbes. So I recommend that if you want to dig in to finding out some really cool things about this period of the Reformation into the Enlightenment some context for maybe perhaps expanding your view about Calvin and things that he had to say in his influence. Dr. McNutt is also an ordained teaching elder in the Presbyterian Church USA, as is her husband. So if you have clergy questions, she can answer those too. Although that will not be the subject of her talk tonight. And a fun fact that I think you'll find very interesting is that she attended St. Andrews with Prince William and Kate and was interviewed about him on national TV after graduation. So that's, that's...
Claim to fame.
That is, forget Calvin. British royalty, that's where it's at. Okay, well, actually, this talk will not be about British royalty. The work that she'll be presenting this evening was featured in Christianity Today recently and won their inaugural Science Essay Prize. So without further ado, I present Jennifer McNutt, who's going to talk about, unforgotten or unrecognized contributions by various pastors to scientific developments in this period across the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries. So,
thank
welcome,
you.
Jennifer.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. I hope it's more interesting than Calvin and Hobbes, but that's hard to beat. It's an honor to be delivering the McIntyre Lecture this evening. I want to thank Robert Bishop for inviting me. He and I have been able to be collaborators in the classroom, and we're friends, and so it's a wonderful combination. To begin, I want to set my study of the forgotten figures, how pastors of the Enlightenment helped advance modern science. I want to set it in the context of my own journey, exploring the topic of Christianity in relationship with science. So like every other kid growing up in the late 80s and early 90s, I too was fervently interested in going to space camp. Despite what I can only describe as a strongly felt need to experience gravitational weightlessness, as the 1986 movie Space Camp had shown, my educational formation and intellectual identity became primarily and decidedly rooted in the humanities. It was not until my undergraduate days at Westmont College that I developed interest in how science and Christianity intersected, and that's thanks to a wonderful astronomy professor that I had there. And as I reflect on it now, I can see how the liberal arts education burrowed its roots deeply into my sense and experience of the world, shaping my questions, guiding my engagement, and expanding and broadening my interest in learning well beyond my comfort zone in the humanities. Liberal arts is what opened my mind to the sciences. After a biblical languages focus at Westmont College and a Master of Divinity at Princeton Theological Seminary, I found myself in the PhD program in modern history at the University of St. Andrews. And my doctoral work was endeavoring to tackle the question of the relationship between religion and the Enlightenment from the perspective of the clergy of Geneva during the 18th century. What really happened when the clerical legacy of French reformer John Calvin encountered the French philosopher Voltaire in Geneva? And as I reflect on that time now, I know that everything that I expected to find in the manuscript records held in the state archives and at the University of Geneva was shaped by a scholarly consensus rooted in the 1970s. I was steeped in historiography, consciously and unconsciously promoting classic secularization theory, which assumed that the inevitable decline of religion in terms of its ability to shape culture, to impact politics, and to guide the hearts and minds of people from the Enlightenment on. But the material did not confirm my expectations. And what I uncovered about the clergy and about their relationship with science ended up finding me rather than the other way around. These discoveries opened the door for me to begin exploring a completely different side of the historical account of Christianity's intersection with science pre-Darwin. And that interest led me to publish my first article on Protestant responses to Gregorian calendar reform in Church History Journal. And my first book, Calvin Meets Voltaire, continued that discovery and led to the Christianity Today article. Since that time, I've been seeking to better understand what was and is and should be the relationship between Christianity and science. Ian Barber, the father of the field of religion and science, posed the question this way: when science meets religion, are they enemies, strangers, or partners? My driving question is this: what happens when clergy meet science? The conflict thesis, the idea that Christianity and science are fundamentally and inherently enemies, is alive and well in our cultural mentality today, and often advanced by both extreme secular and conservative religious sectors. One of my favorite science and religion jokes — this is the historian in me, we like to look at jokes as a reflection of the mentality of an era. So one of my favorite jokes begins with God sitting in heaven and a scientist comes up to him. And the scientist says, "Lord, we don't need you anymore. Science has finally figured out a way to create life out of nothing. In other words, we can do now what you did in the beginning." "Oh, is that so? Tell me," replies God in a very even keel way. "Well," says the scientist, "we can take dirt and form it into the likeness of you and breathe life into it, thus creating humanity." And God responds, "Well, that's interesting. Show me." So the scientist bends down to the earth and starts to mold the soil. "Oh, no, no, no," interrupts God. "Get your own dirt." I think this joke is such a fascinating reflection of the perception that the goal of science is to replace God. And this is not an unfounded accusation when considering the work of the so-called Four Horsemen of New Atheism. One such horseman, Richard Dawkins, has made a mint writing controversial and inflammatory books seeking to prove, in part from historical examples, that Christianity is the enemy of science and has always been the enemy of science. In fact, when I was living in Cambridge, his book, The Dawkins Delusion, came out, and it was everywhere, and everyone was talking about it, so you couldn't avoid it. Dawkins was a biologist and fellow at New College, Oxford, when he wrote The Selfish Gene in 1976, and then the bestseller, The God Delusion, which came out in 2006. By 2007, it had sold over 1.5 million copies and been translated into 31 languages. There he describes God in a truly heinous way as petty, unjust, unforgiving, control freak, a vindictive, bloodthirsty, ethnic cleanser, a misogynistic, homophobic, racist, and I won't go on, but he does. According to his historical rendition of the story, scientific advancement was not only independent of Christian origin, but it thrived despite Christianity's age-long antagonism. And so Alistair McGrath, the famous apologist of Wycliffe Hall, Oxford, responded with the Dawkins delusion. At one point, he reflected, one of the most melancholy aspects of the God delusion is how its author appears to have made the transition from a scientist with a passionate concern for truth to a crude anti-religious propagandist who shows a disregard for evidence. McGrath argues that Dawkins' work perpetuates that overly simplified perception that science good, religion bad, science right, religion wrong. And yet the idea of Christianity at war with science did not originate with Dawkins. At the end of the 19th century, the story of Christianity in conflict with science captured the Western mindset as an established pattern, evident before even Copernicus's heliocentric universe supposedly set Christendom's teeth on edge. In 1874, John William Draper wrote the best-selling book, History of the Conflict Between Religion and Science. Two decades later, in 1896, Draper's work was eclipsed by Andrew Dixon White's A History of the Warfare of Science with Theology in Christendom. White was the co-founder and then first president of Cornell University from 1865, which was to be, in his words, an asylum for science from religious incursion. It goes without saying that both authors characterized the two fields as historically in conflict with each other. White charged Christianity with halting scientific development as early as Archimedes. His work, yes, that deserves a response. His work described the triumph of science over religion akin to emancipation from terror and fanaticism. He singled out prominent Protestant pastors, such as John Wesley, Increase, and Cotton Mather, and the entire Lutheran Church of Sweden for promoting an attack on the new science, stating, "From the first to last, a long line of eminent divines, Anglican and Calvinistic, strove to resist new thought." The impact of his work was considerable. As David Lindbergh and Ronald Numbers have written, no work has done more than White's to instill in the public mind a sense of the adversarial relationship between science and religion. Yet there are numerous evidences as to why these histories should give us pause in the evaluation of clerical attitudes towards science. For one, the year that Draper published his book, in 1874, the 55th annual report of the Methodist Missionary Society was also written and published. How many of you have read that? It's actually really interesting. And it offers a helpful case study of contemporary clerical attitudes at the end of the 19th century towards scientific advancement that very year. Setting aside the fact that a firm conviction in American exceptionalism seems to be driving the fervor of the missionary efforts, what is fascinating about the reports that year is how the idea of scientific advancement and technology in conflict with Christianity is completely foreign to their mindset, even in a post-Darwinian context. On the contrary, society's booming technological expansion was completely wedded in their minds to the reality of Christian civilization, as it was called. Any fear that scientific advancement and modernity would lead to disbelief was unconscionable, according to what is conveyed in these reports. Strikingly, the advancement of technology was actually seen as a witness to the truth and superiority of Christianity and all that it can achieve. Thus, in early December of 1874, at Christ Church in Pittsburgh, Reverend Dr. A.C. George gave an address, and he declared that Christian civilization alone could defeat paganism, merely by encounter rather than persuasion. In his words, Christian civilization was marked by steamships, railways, telegraphs, the microscope, the spectroscope, the printing press will shame paganism out of existence. He continued declaring, in one word, commerce, intercourse, contact of nation with nation, the power of steam and the power of lightning will depaganize the nations of the earth. It will be growingly manifest that such a product as Christian civilization must result from forces or factors infinitely greater than anything which heathen nations possess. As a matter of fact, today in all countries where European lines of travel are established, where the citizens of Christian states are often met, where the material civilization of Christianity shows its beautiful and useful forms, the faith is weakened in the old idolatry. There's a lot going on here, obviously. But technology as a witness to the truth of Christianity is declared with confidence. And it is reported that the speech was received enthusiastically. The eloquent, thrilling appeal with which the doctor concluded will long be remembered by those who heard it and bring forth fruit. This is just one of many examples which indicate how the warfare characterizations of the clergy fall short of faithfully representing historical records and historical mindsets. And this example was nearly embedded in the normal functioning of church institutional life. It's a facet of their mentality rather than a subject of their directed focus. Its power, to illustrate my points, rests in its, I think, unnecessary inclusion. Tonight, I want to highlight some interesting and multifaceted ways that pastors in the 18th century in particular defied the anti-science stereotype. And these examples can remind us that clergy were often the most educated individuals within their contexts, so their openness to intellectual interests should not be surprising to us. Moreover, through their stories, we are reminded that the professional and institutional divide between serving as a pastor and working as a scientist was not yet formalized, so overlap and integration was in no way regarded as defined culturally acceptable professional boundaries. Finally, their stories can illustrate for us just how multidimensional pastoral ministry could be for the 18th century clergymen. The fact that they were engaging, advancing, popularizing scientific developments with their time is not merely a mark of their positive enthusiasm for the emerging new science in many cases, but a manifestation of their theological convictions that new science was providing the opportunity for God to better the physical lives of his people and to enrich their spiritual lives at the same time. And so when we consider the clergy of the past engaging with science, there is in fact evidence of partnership, of dialogue, of integration through their own involvement, their own explanations, and even their own financial support. Some of the clergy I will highlight are very well known to you, though perhaps not for the contributions that I will feature. Others you have likely never heard of before. On the whole, my paper claims that clergy are the forgotten figures who have helped contribute to the advancement of modern science. It seems appropriate then to begin with the great Anglican priest and founder of Methodism, John Wesley, who has frequently been maligned and discounted by 19th and 20th century scholars for advancing an anti-science attitude. In 1876, Sir Leslie Stephen's History of English Thought in the 18th century singled out Wesley for his aversion to scientific reasoning as characteristic of orthodox theologians. Andrew Dixon White would propel this interpretation of Wesley into acceptance with numerous jabs at him throughout his book, as I've already hinted at. As recent as the bicentennial edition of Wesley's diaries in 1988, his habits and attitudes are presented in tension as genuine scientific curiosity and anti-science prejudice. So this thesis is alive and well. The story of John Wesley will not be unknown to us here tonight. He, along with his brother, were the great instigators of revival within the Church of England that would lead to the establishment of Methodism, one of the most important global Protestant traditions to this day. And Wesley was also a man of his time, with a lifelong interest in the natural sciences and a burgeoning concern for advancing access to medical care for the underprivileged. Wesley's reflections and appreciation for the natural sciences are typical of other pastors of the age as well. His letters and writings are filled with observations and considerations of topics ranging from Locke's essay on human understanding to the celebrated empiricism of Roger Bacon to the astonishing successes of recent blood transfusion procedures. He's got lots of stories about that, to anatomical studies of humans and animals. Wesley engaged with Newtonian thought, considering topics of light, optics, atmosphere, and more. He praised technological advancements such as the pyrometer for studying air, the thermometer, and the air pump. He celebrated the invention of the telescope by Galileo and the use of the microscope, saying, "In how many things in all bodies, as well as in the human, which eluded all the art and industry of the ancients, have the moderns discovered by the help of microscopes? Although these are not properly a modern invention, it being certain something of this kind was in use many hundreds of years ago, there are several works of great antiquity still extant, the beauties of which cannot even be discerned, much less could they have been wrought by the finest naked eye which ever was in the world." These writings were often typical for a clergyman of his time. They reflect a high level of engagement rather than antipathy. Yet they were more than an opportunity for personal reflection. In 1758, Wesley began to prepare a piece that was eventually published in 1763, entitled A Survey of the Wisdom of God in Creation, or A Compendium of Natural Philosophy. By 1777, that publication had grown to 5 volumes. By his own words, this was a compilation for the common person. And he explains it in the following way: "God does not impart to us the knowledge of himself immediately. That is not the plan he has chosen. But he has commanded the heavens and the earth to proclaim his existence, to make him known to us. He has endued us with facilities susceptible of his divine language and has raised up men who explore their beauties and become their interpreters." I find that particularly interesting when it comes to the clergy, that that's what they're doing. They're interpreting these things for the common person. Similarly, Wesley's attention to medical care should be understood in light of his larger ministry to the impoverished. After Wesley experienced his heart strangely warm toward God in May 1738, he turned his attention to minister to the lower classes living in impoverished areas. And he did it firstly by taking his ministry outside of the church building. On April 2nd, 1739, in a field in Bristol known as the Glass House, Wesley preached in the open air. And his approach to evangelism provocatively challenged social norms of the time and would prove definitive for the character of Methodist preaching from that point. What we think of Wesley, when we think of Wesley, we perhaps thinking about him riding around on horseback, right? Does everybody, you know, supposedly 20,000 miles a year? Did you know that? 800 sermons a year, delivering 800 sermons a year. That is the staggering statistic. I think that makes every Methodist proud. And I'm not a Methodist, but I think that's true. Who could add anything else to that schedule? The fact is that Wesley's concern for the everyday person went well beyond itinerant preaching. His pastoral care was multifaceted. It incorporated and advanced the emerging scientific practices and understandings for a broader audience. In 1747, Wesley published a medical book called Primitive Physic, or An Easy and Natural Method of Curing Most Diseases. He was humble. It would have a run of 37 editions just until 1859, offering over 900 recipes for medical remedies. Over the course of Wesley's lifetime alone, it went through 23 editions. And it is considered to be one of the most popular medical volumes published in 18th century England, perhaps because it only cost 1 shilling and was therefore accessible. In 1789, the book found its way to America and was published in Philadelphia with short prefaces written by Francis Asbury and Thomas Coke, recommending the book to an American audience. I think of it kind of like WebMD. Everybody know WebMD? It's meant to be a layman's tool for self-diagnosis and remedy. According to Wesley's postscript to the 1755 edition written at Bristol, he says the following: "It is my design to set down cheap and safe and easy medicines, easily to be known, easy to be procured, and easy to be applied by plain, unlettered men." It's the common person's book. It's not so much about what he prescribed. Historians have labeled these remedies anywhere from typical and harmless to absurd. But the fact that he spent his time and energy doing this at all is notable. Sure, we can laugh about his tendency to recommend a cold bath for all sorts of ailments and for the prevention of disease. But the point is that he saw this level of care and involvement as part of his duty as a pastor called by God. And this was not mere advice. John Wesley also founded free medical centers and promoted cutting-edge techniques of electrotherapy. He even purchased 4 electrical machines for use in his medical clinics. The electricity machine is a mark of his concern to advance cutting-edge medical care at the time. And in 1760, he published the following book, Electricity Made Plain and Useful. Paola Bertucci has written, "Being advertised as a cheap treatment that could be afforded by the lower classes, medical electricity fitted well into the philanthropic concerns of Methodism, a religion for the poor." Yet I would respond to that and say, this is not mere philanthropy, but pastoral ministry. J.W. Haas's article on Wesleyan Science in Church History Journal from 2006 is a wonderful corrective to a largely negative historiography on this issue. There he stresses that Wesley was not a participant, but an observer of science as a way to explain he wasn't an innovator of science. He wasn't advancing his own experiments and approaches. I think Haas is correct that Wesley was a synthesizer of the scientific advances of the time, but because of his platform as a clergyman, I would stress that he was more than an observer. Wesley was a proponent for a wide-ranging audience of some of the key scientific approaches driven out of pastoral concern. Finally, Wesley's desire to encourage engagement with science is evident in the fact that science and mathematics were advanced in the curriculum of his schools. According to his address to the clergy in 1756, he urged preachers to study not only philosophy, but natural philosophy, logic, geometry, and psychology. And so for these many reasons and more, any anti-science conclusions about Wesley need to be revisited, or at least complicated. Wesley's sermons were also the context for evaluating scientific discovery. And this approach, because I want to talk about other scholars besides Wesley, I'm going to move to the continent. I'm going to move to the context of Geneva, Switzerland. And I'll just say, though, that Wesley is doing some of the same things we see Wesley doing are the same things that we see Genevan clergymen doing as well. This approach to preaching is evident across the pond in 18th century Geneva. For the Genevan context, developments in the scientific arena were not regarded as detrimental to the status of religion, and therefore the clergy had no objections to certain scientific advancements. They even supported a more visible function of science within the city. Consequently, during the period from 1704 to 1780, so almost the entire century, the presence of scientific activity in the life of the city became apparent with the establishment of experimental facilities. The proposal to construct an observatory was first discussed at the Assembly of the Academic Senate in June 1767, And by September 1770, the Senate chose to bring the proposal before the Company of Pastors. So this also gives you a sense of how the clergy, at least in the context of Geneva, their approval was required when it came to what was happening within the university and within the life of the city. And it was recommended that Jacques-André Mallet be made professor of astronomy. The company then approved this recommendation and talks about this as a way to ensure the advancement of knowledge. The Company of Pastors then proposed to the city, who had just approved this, to also fund the observatory the following year. And this act is considered to be the first effort on behalf of the science of astronomy within the city of Geneva. Soon after, a meteorological building was constructed in 1780, the establishment of a chemistry laboratory was approved. So a lot is happening in the 18th century in Geneva, and the clergy are part of those conversations and supporting them. Meanwhile, during a time when controversy revolved around the establishment of lightning conductors used to protect buildings, particularly church towers, this was in place of the misguided notion that ringing church bells would stave off electrical storms. They were really convinced about that. Geneva did not hesitate to allow for the introduction of lightning rods. Horace Benedict de Saussure, professor of philosophy at Geneva's Academy, constructed a lightning rod for the city of Geneva and also worked with French Catholic abbé Jean-Antoine Nollet on the reciprocity between storms and electricity. So you also see clergy, Protestant and Catholic clergy in the 18th century working together to advance their experiments and to share their results. And they do this in multiple different ways. Once again, the clergy don't stand in the way. Given that White's work on science and religion actually highlights this, the clerical resistance to lightning rods, as support for the warfare thesis, this is actually a really important example to challenge that. These brief examples are intended to convey that the clergy did not object to modernizing scientific instruction at the academy or even activity in the city. In fact, these examples highlight the way in which the professionalization of science was occurring through professorial chairs and experimental buildings. I think one of the points, one of the points to say is that in Geneva, the professors of like mathematics, for example, they were also ordained clergy. So there's a lot of overlap and integration. Consequently, science was progressively becoming a tangible presence within Geneva, proving that although the integration of the new science into the Genevan Academy was a gradual process, the continual support of the clergy towards scientific advancement indicates that it did not cause an ideological conflict from their perspective. In contrast with the work of historians like Paul Hazard and his notion of a crisis generation of the 17th century, the emergence of new science was not regarded by its contemporaries as revolutionary in the Genevan context. So apparently the love of knowledge and a firm conviction in one's Christian identity goes a long way towards opening the door for new understanding. The pulpit, meanwhile, remained an important way in 18th century Geneva for shaping culture as pastors communicated in a particular theological and biblical mindset. So I want to move to highlight how Genevan clergy were integrating science into their preaching in the 18th century. So in Genevan daily life was filled with so many worship services. I mean, actually, there were like 3,000 a year held in the city of Geneva alone. And I've done work on 20% of the sermon manuscripts that are located in Geneva from 1685 to 1798. And I just want to highlight a few examples. The first is from the clergyman Pierre Mouchon. I'm sure you've never heard of him before. He was preaching a sermon on the resurrection of Jesus Christ and sought to emphasize our foundation and hope by stressing the role of sin in the human life and our need for a savior. So, sound familiar? As he explained, he's engaging with 2 Corinthians 5:7. And he describes sin to congregants as corrupted blood that circulates through the body. A truly enlightened explanation of hereditary sin. His explanation reflects the perspective of the time that diseases resulted from fluids like blood, hence the practice of bloodletting rather than resulting from viruses. With this, Mouchon took the orthodox theological understanding of hereditary sin and grounded it in a physiological explanation. And this was an opportunity to affirm, in his words, the magnificent graces of God serve in all times as the counterweight of fleshly corruption, the sin that we cannot escape that is circulating within us at all times. Our hope is in the resurrection. Ezekiel Gallatin pastored the city church of Geneva from 1715 and 1723, and then he was appointed to as professor of philosophy. And one Sunday, Gallatin took up the passage from 1 Corinthians 13 that we now see in a mirror dimly. And he began to reflect on the fact that without the telescope, the naked eye would never have discovered the vast expansiveness of the universe. Similarly, the microscope allowed the discovery of microorganisms 20,000 times smaller than could be seen by the human eye. Or he calls us to turn our attention to the earth under our feet to explore the planets. The plants produce the rocks, the metals, the minerals form the presence of animals. Yet even with all of that, even with the microscope and the telescope, his point being that we literally still see through a lens dimly. I was reminded of another joke. A cartoon I recently saw depicting two astronomers in an observatory. One is looking through the telescope, the other is standing by and nervously saying, "That isn't dark matter, sir. You just forgot to take the lens cap off." We look through a lens dimly. What about gravity? Gallatin notes that varying views on gravity exist, but with reference to the Newtonian mechanistic worldview, Gallatin claims that we may observe the exterior of the machine, but the functioning of the interior springs, so uniform and useful, still remain a mystery. A point that Wesley also mentioned in his preaching. Gallatin then likened humans to a small insect, kind of going to remind you of Jonathan Edwards, to a small insect crawling around the foot of one part of the column of the church building. For him, this was not an opportunity to wallow, but to revel in God's revelation through his son, the promise that our human curiosity and knowledge will be fully satisfied at the end of the age. And he uses the opportunity to affirm our need to understand our world, ourselves, and God, the unique focus of our belief and hope. The clergy of Geneva will disappoint anyone looking for evidence of anti-science. So surely the Puritans, right? I mean, surely the Puritans are opposed to science, scientific advancement. And yet even here we find much continuity with the examples that I have already conveyed. So I want to highlight some different contributions that they've made. Beginning with Increase Mather, he was a contemporary of Isaac Newton and the sixth president of Harvard. You might know him because he was linked to the Salem witch trials. He tried to discount the use of spectral evidence in the courtroom, though he was not successful. Nonetheless, he helped found the Boston Philosophical Society and stringently advocated for pioneering preventative approaches to disease, along with his son, Cotton Mather. In 1721, 60% of Boston's residents contracted smallpox. The medical community, however, was not in support of the smallpox inoculation method yet. And so public debate over the risks versus the benefits of the procedure came to the forefront of the city's newspapers, and it was the clergy who advocated on its behalf. David Copeland called it the most heated newspaper debate in colonial America. Increase published two pieces on the subject that year, including, and this is a long one, but here we go, several reasons proving that inoculation or transplanting the smallpox is a lawful practice and that it has been blessed by God for the saving of many a life. That's the title. I love the titles of 18th century books. When Cotton wrote the first pro-inoculation piece for the Boston Gazette, increase, and 4 other Boston clergy signed it. And someone tried to bomb his house as a result. Mm-hmm. Hopefully that did not work. Many lives were saved and much suffering prevented because of pastoral involvement in this particular case. Cotton Mather also gained widespread acclaim for his observations in botany and writings in nature, and was elected fellow of the Royal Society of London for his work, The Christian Philosopher, a collection of the best discoveries in nature with religious improvements. There, the function, use, beauty, and order of vegetables garnered his attention. That's actually something that John Wesley also raved about. He really loved vegetables. Even matters as seemingly monotonous as the acclimatization of wheat led Cotton to enthusiastically declare God's goodness and his admirable design. To Mather, nature's governance by God was clear in all these amazing evidences of design. But oh, the glorious goodness of our God in all these things. In this way, the exploration of creation was affirmed by Mather with particular enthusiasm. So, well, maybe Jonathan Edwards will fit our our model. So let's think of him. Jonathan Edwards also serves and is an important example of how scientific interests intersected with the life of the Puritan in the 18th century. He was the grandson of the famous minister Solomon Stoddard and educated at Yale College. He is known for being the pastor of the church from which the Great Awakening began in 1734 in Northampton, Massachusetts. His ministry included missions to Native Americans in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, and president of the College of New Jersey, 1757. The following year, though, he died due to complications from smallpox inoculation. So he was willing to try it, though, but that was unfortunately one of the great risks of participating. Edwards' famous sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, is well known for the metaphor used to convey human damnation, namely the spider dangling by a thread over a hot cauldron. That's what everybody read in their high school textbooks, right? In a society that perhaps believes Charlotte to be the only good spider there is, interestingly enough, identifying believers with the spider was not so much of an insult to him. In fact, as a teenage boy, Edwards was quite interested in arachnids, highly interested in natural philosophy, not experiments, but observation, particularly arachnids. During his senior year of college, he wrote an account of flying spiders, investigating how they could fly such long distances from tree to tree. He recounts the discovery of the filament they released, allowing them to float in the air by contracting or letting it out. And he sees God's providence in numerous ways. He says, "We hence see the exuberant goodness of the Creator, who hath not only provided for all the necessities, but also for the pleasure and recreation of all sorts of creatures, even the insects and those that are most despicable." But about the spider, of all insects, no one is more wonderful than the spider, especially with respect to their sagacity and admirable way of working. That is Jonathan Edwards on spiders. In fact, throughout his education, Edwards created notebooks on natural science to pursue particular interests in optics. For example, is evident. He avidly studied Newton's optics out of interest in rainbows and light rays. And one of his earliest entries seeks to show from Newton's principles of light and color why the sky is blue, the sun is not perfectly white. He adopts Newtonian worldview regarding motion, as one entry recorded, to show how the motion, rest, and direction of the least atom has an influence on the motion, rest, and direction of every body in the universe. As George Marsden has concluded, the New England clergy, being the best educated persons in their communities, were often the chief interpreters of the new science. So, in conclusion, pastors after the scientific revolution viewed engagement with new science as an opportunity to improve human life and understand God as creator with greater depth in order to bring him greater glory. And so they were frequent promoters rather than detractors, enthusiasts and participants rather than fear-mongers of these new advances. Their observations and contributions through publishing and preaching contributed to the advancement of modern science in Western communities. They help their communities understand and interpret the new science transforming their world. And they did this through preaching. They modeled and advocated engagement with science as they integrated into their ministry. And one of the facets of my Christianity Today article, the purpose of that was to say that that's also what we need in our churches today. We also need Christians who are engaged and interested and learning and hearing about science and in dialogue with science. And that can be interpreted and discussed within the context of our churches. That engagement is what the 18th century models for us, and it is still needed in our world today. There's no denying that there are many tensions today over various issues that overlap between science and Christianity. Evolutionary theory, climate change, the historical Adam and Eve, just to name a few. Today, the fear that science will replace God is primarily founded in the more extreme sectors of conservative Christianity. But meanwhile, the cultural conversation has moved on from the 20th century debate to a new debate. It seems to me that the new debate is, will the sciences, will STEM replace the humanities? The question behind the question is clear to me. Now that science, from a secular perspective, has replaced God, will it also replace humanity, so to speak? As we face the brink of a robotic culture, this is not an unfounded question. As a University of Wisconsin campus undervalues the humanities to the point of eliminating 13 majors from its curriculum most recently, it is not an unfounded question. Most of you may know that Marilyn Robinson was on campus. Anybody hear her? Yeah, a few? One of the greatest proponents of the humanities today, just by the sheer excellence of her work, as recognized by all. And when asked about why to value the humanities, she responded eloquently, "The humanities humanize." Our response then should not be to argue, as so many in the blogosphere, that the humanities are greater than the sciences, or that the sciences are greater than the humanities, but that the sciences and the humanities need each other. Both disciplines seek to make sense of human life, to enrich and empower human flourishing in expert ways that are critical to our time on earth. And I think the Christian then has a key role in that disciplinary conversation. As for Christianity and science, Christianity is always denied a Gnostic tendency of each era, from the very start of the faith to even now, the tendency to overly spiritualize and undervalue material components of human life. And at the same time, Christianity must also stand against the glorification of the material, when only the author of our material world deserves such glorification. I was speaking this weekend in another context, and a woman came up and told me a story. She said that she was outside with her neighbor who was looking at this telescope, and they were looking through this telescope, and she said, you know, the heavens declare the glory of God. And he said, no, the heavens declare the glory of science. And they entered into an interesting and contentious conversation. As we stand in the season of the Eastertide still, we are reminded of the fact that we follow a God who took on flesh, was born, died, and resurrected in a bodily way. And I was recently reminded of how God still provides in a material way. So I want to end with a little story. I like to read about the latest things going on in science. So I recently came across this article. It was talking about one of the greatest challenges of our world, that our world is facing today, is our growing immunity to antibiotics. Have you guys read this? Yeah? So it was talking about the reality of superbugs and their mutations and resistance to drugs, that how that has become a serious concern with the scientific and medical communities. And that the antibiotics grown in labs and in petri dishes are no longer having the impact that they need to have. And so for that reason, it was this big news, I don't know if you saw it, that scientists have discovered a new powerful class of an antibiotic. And where did they find it? Does anybody know?
Soil.
In the dirt.
Yep.
Just there. In the soil. waiting. The thing that we absolutely need right now, just there in the dirt, waiting, ready to be discovered. As Albert Einstein said in a 1940 conference paper, science without religion is lame. Religion without science is blind. Thank you.
Great, so we have some time for questions. So I'd like to encourage students to jump right in and ask questions. Maybe you can be the first, but definitely feel free to speak up. So any questions for Dr. McNutt?
You mentioned Wesley using electricity. What was the source of electricity in those days?
This is the man to explain how the machines work. I talk about what they thought about them.
Would they be using storage batteries or what type of thing?
No, that predates not the concept of the battery, but a practical battery. But typically for these sort of electrical either experiments or to use an electric machine, what you needed was human foot power, for example, to then cause a flywheel to rotate that then would generate electricity by depositing it on a sphere that you would charge up and then you would discharge
capacitor.
The sphere. So it's basically a mechanical process.
This is why we worked really well together teaching a class.
To charge a capacitor, in other words.
Well, capacitors don't quite exist, but you can make sort of the same analog by simply depositing charge on a sphere that you can then send by wire to the touch of a person's hand, for example, by grasping the wire. So you become basically the receiver of the charge.
And I'll just add to that I talked about Geneva, and I didn't mention, though, that Geneva was also a context where one of the clergymen there, Jean Jalabert, was also involved in advancing electrotherapy along with Abbé Nollet. And they were basically sharing their experiments and their their results. And and the company of pastors was very supportive of him. His father was the first to chair the chair of mathematics to hold that chair. He was a French refugee who came after the revocation of the Edict of Nantes in 1685. And so they had a really strong relationship with that family, and they gave him lots of opportunities to travel, to meet with other scientists in the regions, to bring back, to write his book on the experiments with electricity. And they really like propped him up quite a bit. So it just goes to show that the engagement with electricity is happening in multifaceted contexts, in various contexts.
Other questions?
Is there anything in what you have researched that kind of speaks to the issue of science versus superstition in terms of understanding the world?
Yes, yeah, that's really interesting. It can be hard to navigate some of the attitudes of the past. Oftentimes when in 18th century context, post-Reformation and Protestant context, they are often using the word superstition to refer to Catholicism. And oftentimes too, when they use that word, they might also link it to like transubstantiation and the views on the Eucharist, because of course that is still the most divisive and controversial doctrine of the Reformation. So it can be a little bit hard sometimes to negotiate where a person who's critical of superstition actually fits in the conversation, because there's lots of different angles. But I think one thing that's very helpful that comes out of my own work on religion and the Enlightenment, so Enlightenment in general, of course, science is part of that, is just that there are many different responses to the valuing of reason. Today now we have a much more complex and nuanced way to talk about what's happening to religion during the Enlightenment era. Now some scholars have been able to talk about different categories like the radical enlightenment, the moderate enlightenment, and the religious enlightenment. And actually, all of the clergy that I'm mentioning here, they're all part of the religious enlightenment. And you can see how they fit, and that would be another paper, but you can see how they fit into that category because they believe that Christianity is reasonable, okay? God is reasonable. But that doesn't mean that humanity will ever reach the fullness of God's reason. So there is a limitation, there's a humility that is maintained in the distinction between the creature and the creator. That's really important to distinguishing a religious enlightenment figure from a moderate enlightenment figure. Because a moderate enlightenment figure is always going to say, I'm judging revelation according to the standards of reason, right? And so if a miracle doesn't fit with what I think is reasonable, what says in the Bible, then it's not true, okay? But a religious enlightenment figure will say that everything is reasonable, but I must not understand how it is reasonable in God's way. And so, consequently, I think that these clergy, like even Wesley, one of the reasons why Wesley is critiqued as anti-science is because he believes that human knowledge has limitations, you know? And you even heard that in Ezekiel Gallatin's sermon. Like, yes, we've got the telescope, yes, we've got the microscope, but we still, there's so much we don't know because God is so great. So you kind of see both and to me, it's a precursor to a Kantian perspective on the limits that we have of, you know, with human knowledge and reason. Is that helpful?
Steve. I just wanted to say one thing back when we were on electricity.
Oh, please.
I had a question. Yeah. His Majesty's Royal Navy started putting copper sheathing on all its ships to keep barnacles from growing and boring into the wood.
Oh.
And by sailing this copper through salt water, they were causing all the fittings on the vessels to prematurely corrode.
Right.
And so they were but they didn't figure this out right away.
Right.
Right, why this was happening. So ships were just falling apart prematurely. And as they were creating that current, unintentionally. In any case.
Oh, that's fascinating.
That wasn't my question, though.
Oh, okay.
I loved what you had to say about the optimism about progress in the 19th century.
Oh, yeah.
Where some people call it, you know, the Christian century, right? And the optimism around that, and of tying the progress of Christianity and the progress of science are wedded so closely together.
Yeah, that was
early in your talk. I see the opposite of that in the 20th century,
yeah,
where historians really turn on science, right? Especially after the atomic age, saying, look at what science has wrought, right? And so taking a very dark view of science. And then also with the environmental degradation.
Yes.
And so putting
technology.
Right,
yeah.
And so putting science and technology first in the same boat and then sinking the boat. And so
that's amazing.
That's something I wanted to look at more, but I haven't had time to.
Yeah.
Sort of that whole reversal, where now as you read just a mainstream history textbook, in the 20th century, it's just repeatedly throwing science and technology under the bus.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You know, I think you get a lot of it too in some historians when they talk about like the industrial age as well. It's sort of like that fear that the machine is going to replace the human is already evident in the ways that factories and, you know, the treatment of factory workers some of those problems that the 19th century faced. So I think you do see some of that concern in the 19th century, and you certainly see it of historians evaluating the 19th century later. So I was really surprised. Don't you just love that? You know, when you're doing your research, you don't know what you're going to find. It's wonderful to discover a whole new mentality, you know, that you couldn't make up. that's the joy of archival research. And so, yeah, I did not expect that level of optimism, especially, but what it reminded me was that even after Darwin, with some of the top theologians, like Charles Hodge and B.B. Warfield, they're still trying to find, they're not so turned off by science. They're finding ways to engage with the scientific discoveries. They're not embracing them necessarily wholesale or definitively, but they're allowing for plausibility, and they're able to think creatively about their hermeneutics of scripture and about their theology. And I think that's what we need. It's not that we need clergy or theologians or Christians to simply accept wholesale what science is telling us, because the problem is that science changes its mind and we're left holding the bag, you know? So there's gotta be a prudence and there's gotta be a caution, but isolation is not the answer. That's where things get scary, is in the isolation.
Thank you. I enjoyed your lecture very much, as usual. You mentioned John Wesley's book on the survey of the wisdom of God in creation, which implicitly suggests that God had a wisdom in creating life. That is, this is a continuum, a taxonomic, nomenclatural kind of category, where Wesley seems to value the fact that God created life. I wonder if you have thought about how Wesley thought about God's wisdom in creating life, because I see very little literature writing about the wisdom of God in creating life.
Yeah. So you mean in creating life at all, or in the ongoing sort of function?
The whole thing. I mean, it's all the phenomena of life. But creating life is such a miraculous thing, and it's perpetuated, and yet we don't write about it.
Yeah. I think, for example, he shows some of the appreciation and some of the hesitancy that I mentioned. The example that comes to mind has to do with motion, right? Because of the affirmation that motion is critical to sort of getting things going, right? Getting life going, it requires motion. And that even though he says, well, maybe gravitation is right, you know, he doesn't necessarily accept it. And that's what drives some people nuts. Like, that really frustrates people. But he says, maybe it's right. But this is in the context of a sermon. And his point is that God is the true instigator of motion. So I kind of see them not necessarily getting at all the details of exactly how things work, allowing for he loves natural philosophy, so allowing for the discovery of how nature works to bring glory to God, but at the same time suspending his judgments on some of the latest concerns. If he thinks, for example, that he obviously was concerned that gravity was perhaps taking the place of an honor that is owed ultimately to God. And so I see him juggling that, which is actually the same thing that we juggle as Christians today, isn't it? So.
I've got an anecdote for you, but also kind of a cosmic question about interpreting these things.
Oh, dear.
I've been working in 19th century religion and science, and I've seen an article in the newspaper that, I don't know if they were doing this, but missionaries in India were taking microscopes to demonstrate to the Brahmins that their vegetarianism doesn't make sense. You can't drink a cup of water without eating an animal.
Oh my goodness.
That's
fascinating. The Missionary Society papers will say for sure. They reveal a lot.
It wasn't a religious magazine, not a particular journal.
Yeah.
But I'm going to float a thesis and tell me how much you think this works. My work parallels yours a lot.
Okay.
It seems to me that one of the things that's going on is not just intellectual tensions between scientific ideas and religious ideas, it's where knowledge lives in the society.
Yes.
We live in a world where the church is now a private sphere thing. We speak to ourselves, we try to speak to society. Mm-hmm. And society now has its own world of the intellect. Mm-hmm. And science is perhaps the most powerful authority in that world of the intellect. Mm-hmm. But in most of Western history since Christianity, the church has been the arbitrator, the creator, the custodian of knowledge.
Right.
So the clergy you talked about, I mean, to me it's not surprising, because
yep.
By what other institution is knowledge generated, evaluated, and disseminated?
That's right.
It's through the church.
Yeah.
And to think in other terms, that pulpits used to be also the village newspaper before newspapers. Where does information get announced about things going on in the world?
Yeah.
The only place people had for communication was the church and the pulpit. So in a sense, what happened is the church played a larger role in society. Aside from delivering the religious message, it really was the conduit of any kind of intellectual activity.
Yeah.
And it seems to me in the course of the 19th century, that got displaced in lots of ways. The administrative state, in one way, higher education levels,
yes,
and things like that. So when we perceive religion and science today as being in separate spheres, and then we project that back in the past and look for either harmony or conflict, we're overlooking the fact that the very shape of knowledge is different today, culturally different, than it has been up until really, I suspect it's the middle of the 19th century, that we really get that transition going on. And it sounds like your work seems to confirm that, as you talked about professionalization, mm-hmm, institutions. I mean, the company of pastors in Geneva was not a group of clergy in a city. They were the culture of Geneva, right?
They were, and beyond.
Yeah.
Because Geneva continued to be the mother church of the Reformed tradition in Europe, which is another part of what Geneva was doing was what other churches worldwide in that tradition were seeking to do as well.
So here's my caution, though, it seems to me, because I'm very sensitive about, because we're so attuned to this culture that thinks religion and science are opposites, and to Dawkins and all these crazy people that are reinforcing that, and lots of people who think you have to choose between the two. We have kind of a paranoia about. So then when we find something that seems to speak against that, and I've done work that contributes to the demolishing of the conflict thesis as well, but you get the impression that we kind of grab those things and say, look, we've been part of this all along, and that's true, but I think that we have to be careful that what's changing is not just that Christians are okay with science.
Sure.
But there's a larger cultural change that's going on, and that we shouldn't just use this to wave our own flag. We have to look at the larger picture. About our role in culture today. I don't know if I'm being clear about this.
I feel like I'm trying to say that as well. That our role in culture is to engage, is to dialogue, is to listen, is to interpret, right? So that's one of the things I was thinking. I agree what you're saying. I'll say with this. That's not your question.
I don't know if it's more subtle, but
okay.
To a lot of Christians here, you're talking, say, great, we can talk about clergy supporting science, and they're absolutely right. Empirically, that's correct. And then we use that as an apologetic to say to people like Dawkins, well, you're wrong. Listen, we've been supporting this all along. Mm-hmm. But the phenomenon isn't so much that Christians support science, which is true empirically, but the phenomenon is that they play a role that's different than we do now.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, they support science, that's fine, but it's not the same thing as saying that Christianity is perhaps the especially appropriate home for science or things like that, because we're drawing examples from a period which Christianity plays a different cultural role than it does today.
I think still a lot of the clergy I'm mentioning are not necessarily in the realm of developing their own science, but again, receiving it and encouraging it and advancing it. But there are some that are, which was the caveat at first. Just expanding what I did just in this one paper to say that, you know, the conversation is broader than just going to church on Sunday and listening to a sermon. The sermons themselves were published, they were circulating, people were reading them, you know, regularly. And so that was real broad cultural engagement beyond the singular moment of, you know, communicating whatever it is, a humility, a caution, an encouragement, a support. It seems very multifaceted. And so similarly, I think then we see that with the radio, right? The emergence of the use of the radio. And then even today, the podcast has a similar kind of role in encouraging that conversation. Because what I think what I worry about more than what you're saying, like an apologetic, first is that understanding the historical account accurately matters. It matters for our conversation today in the church. It matters for our society today and how it views Christianity. But the results of that, not only that have historiography has been perhaps more of an isolation. It's been the greater concern that I see then is the emergence of a scientism, a culture that is dominated by scientism that therefore does not even value a dialogue, a conversation with other sectors of knowledge like the humanities. And I'm thinking of theology and in that context as well. So that's the thing that I think is really important to show then that's the naturalism, some of the errors of naturalism, the fact that science is not as isolated as some have tended to assume, that there's more interaction, that there's human involvement, human engagement in scientific discovery that is essential, that is part of ascertaining knowledge. You can't remove that human component. In that way, I see perhaps a link. So, but I'd have to develop that in a different paper. Thank you.
Yes, in the back.
So there are a couple of questions that I want to ask on that line, but one that is more closely related to part of what you're talking about is, are clergy participating in kind of constructive scientific engagement because they're scientists, because they are the lettered men, or because they are kind of self-consciously doing ministry? And I realize those are not necessarily exclusive, but do they reflect on it? Like Wesley's writing this medical book, does it say, like, I'm doing this because I care about the people in my congregation, their lives, because I'm a Christian? Or,
I mean, I read a quote where he, in his preface, says that he's writing this for the common person. And in order to understand what he means by that, you'd have to put that in the context of his larger ministry. And some people don't understand what it meant for him to walk outside a church building and preach in the open air. That was for the common person. His whole ministry in that way was shaped for the common person. And to preach in open air is yet one example. The writing of this book is another example of what that means. But there are some clergy who are ordained. It could be, it's always hard for the historian to get at the true internal motivations of a human being. So I am not God, and I cannot necessarily read the heart. Nonetheless, it does seem that in some contexts, in order to do that work, you would have to go through clerical training. I'm thinking of Jean Jalabert. It seems like his heart was more in this developing the science itself, whereas Wesley's heart was not so much in developing it all, but in bringing it free to people that he's caring for in multifaceted ways, with his socioeconomic and spiritual care, sides of his care. So maybe it depends then on the particular individual, or they represent different groups. Thank you.
You made a comment that fascinates me about ministers publishing their sermons.
How, yes.
Was this the run-of-the-mill ministers or just the elites?
Right. I will venture to say that a lot of the pastors that were publishing, you would not know today, but they would have been known in their time. So, and then some that are publishing, you would know today. So I guess it depends on, that perspective. Not everybody has their sermons published, so that is definitely true. It's more of the more... sometimes it's because particular clergy were very good at working with publishing houses. It kind of reminds me of like Martin Luther, for example. He was very good at working with the printing industry in the 16th century. He knew how to use it. And we see that with some of the clergy in the 18th century. They know how to engage with that side of what was happening. And sermons were one of the most popular things that people read in the European culture of the time. So
Yeah, Luther's books are like this on a shelf.
Yes, yeah, over time. So even Calvin's, all of Calvin's, John Calvin's sermons have not been published, which is, so even the clergy that we think, you know, would be fully published have not yet been.
Any other questions? Let's thank Jennifer again.